of cells was governed by genes. Every adult hermaphrodite worm has 959 cells, but if you counted the cells generated during worm development, a total of 1,090 cells were actually born. It was a small discrepancy, but it fascinated Horvitz endlessly. 131 extra cells had somehow disappeared. They had been produced during development, but then killed during the maturation of the worm. These cells were the castaways of development, the lost children of Genesis. When Sulston and Horvitz used their lineage maps to track the deaths of the 131 lost cells, they found that only specific cells produced at specific times were killed. It was a selective purge. Like everything else in the worm's development, nothing was left to chance. The death of these cells, or rather their planned self-willed suicide, also seemed genetically programmed. Programmed death? Geneticists were just contending with the programmed life of worms. Was death, too, controlled by genes? In 1972, John Kerr, an Australian pathologist, had observed a similar pattern of cell death in normal tissues and in cancers. Until Kerr's observations, biologists had thought of death as a largely accidental process caused by trauma, injury, or infection, a phenomenon called necrosis, literally blackening. Necrosis was typically accompanied by the decomposition of tissues, leading to the formation of pus or gangrene. But in certain tissues, Kerr noted, dying cells seemed to activate specific structural changes in anticipation of death, as if turning on a death subroutine. The dying cells did not elicit gangrene, wounds, or inflammation. They acquired a pearly, wilting translucence, like lilies in a vase before they die. If necrosis was blackening, then this was death by whiteout. Instinctively, Kurz surmised that the two forms of dying were fundamentally different. This controlled cell deletion, he wrote, is an active, inherently programmed phenomenon, controlled by genes of death. Seeking a word to describe the process, he called it apoptosis, an evocative Greek word for the falling off of leaves from trees or petals from a flower. But what did these genes of death look like? Horvitz and Sulston made yet another series of mutants, except these were not altered in cell lineage, but in patterns of cellular death. In one mutant, the contents of the dying cells could not be adequately fragmented into pieces. In another mutant, dead cells were not removed from the worm's body, resulting in carcasses of cells littering its edges, like naples on a trash strike. The genes altered in these mutants, Horvitz surmised, were the executioners, scavengers, cleaners, and cremators of the cellular world, the active participants in the killing. The next set of mutants had even more dramatic distortions and patterns of death. The carcasses were not even formed. In one worm, all 131 dying cells remained alive. In another, specific cells were spared from death. Horvitz's students nicknamed the mutant worms the undead, or wombies, for worm zombies. The inactivated genes in these worms were the master regulators of the death cascade in cells. Horvitz named them sed genes, for C. elegans, death. Remarkably, several genes that regulate cell death would soon be implicated in human cancers. Human cells also possess genes that orchestrate their death via apoptosis. Many of these genes are ancient, and their structures and functions are similar to those of the death genes found in worms and flies. In 1985, the cancer biologist Stanley Korsmeier discovered that a gene named BCL2 is recurrently mutated in lymphomas. BCL2, it turned out, was the human counterpart to one of Horvitz's death-regulating worm genes called SED9. In worms, SED9 prevents cell death by sequestering the cell death-related executioner proteins, hence the undead cells in the worm mutants. In human cells, the activation of BCL2 results in a cell in which the death cascade is blocked, creating a cell that is pathologically unable to die, cancer. But was the fate of every cell in the worm dictated by genes and only genes? Horvitz and Sulston discovered occasional cells in the worm, rare pairs, that could choose one fate or another randomly, as if by coin flip. The fate of these cells was not determined by their genetic destiny, but by their proximity to other cells. Two worm biologists working in Colorado, David Hirsch and Judith Kimball, called this phenomenon natural ambiguity. But even natural ambiguity was sharply constrained, Kimball found. The identity of an ambiguous cell was, in fact, regulated by signals from neighboring cells, but the neighboring cells were themselves genetically pre-programmed. The god of worms had evidently left tiny loopholes of chance in the worm's design, but he still wouldn't throw dice. A worm was thus constructed from two kinds of inputs, intrinsic inputs from genes and extrinsic inputs from cell-cell interactions. Jokingly, Brenner called it the British model versus the American model. The British way, Brenner wrote, is for cells to do their own thing and not to talk to their neighbors very much. Ancestry is what counts, and once a cell is born in a certain place, it will stay there and develop according to rigid rules. The American way is quite the opposite. Ancestry does not count. What counts is the interactions with its neighbors. It frequently exchanges information with its fellow cells, and often has to move to accomplish its goals and find its proper place. What if you forcibly introduce chance, fate, into the life of a worm? In 1978, Kimball moved to Cambridge and began to study the effects of sharp perturbations on cell fates. She used a laser to singe and kill single cells in a worm's body. The ablation of one cell could change the fate of a neighboring cell, she found, but under severe constraints. Cells that had already been genetically predetermined had almost no leeway in altering their destinies. In contrast, cells that were naturally ambiguous were more pliant, but even so, their capacity to alter their destiny was limited. Extrinsic cues could alter intrinsic determinants, but to a point. You could whisk the man in a gray flannel suit off the Piccadilly line and stuff him on the Brooklyn-bound F train. He would be transformed, but still emerge from the tunnels wanting beef pasties for lunch. Chance played a role in the microscopic world of worms, but it was severely constrained by genes. The gene was the lens through which chance was filtered and refracted. The discoveries of gene cascades that govern the lives and deaths of flies and worms were revelations for embryologists, but their impact on genetics was just as powerful. In solving Morgan's puzzle, how do genes specify a fly, embryologists had also solved a much deeper riddle. How can units of heredity generate the bewildering complexity of organisms? The answer lies in organization and interaction. A single master regulatory gene might encode a protein with rather limited function, an on and off switch for 12 other target genes, say. But suppose the activity of the switch depends on the concentration of the protein, and the protein can be layered in a gradient across the body of an organism, with a high concentration at one end and a low concentration at the other. This protein might flick on all 12 of its targets in one part of an organism, 8 in another segment, and only 3 in yet another. Each combination of target genes, 12, 8, and 3, might then intersect with yet other protein gradients and activate and repress yet other genes. Add the dimensions of time and space to this recipe, i.e. when and where a gene might be activated or repressed, and you can begin to construct intricate fantasias of form. By mixing and matching hierarchies, gradients, switches, and circuits of genes and proteins, an organism can create the observed complexity of its anatomy and physiology. As one scientist described it, individual genes are not particularly clever. This one cares only about that molecule, that one only about some other molecule. But that simplicity is no barrier to building enormous complexity. If you can build an ant colony with just a few different kinds of simple-minded ants, workers, drones, and the like, think about what you can do with 30,000 cascading genes deployed at will. The geneticist Antoine Danchon once used the parable of the Delphic boat to describe the process by which individual genes could produce the observed complexity of the natural world. In the proverbial story, the oracle at Delphi is asked to consider a boat on a river whose planks have begun to rot. As the wood decays, each plank is replaced one by one, and after a decade, no plank is left from the original boat. Yet the owner is convinced that it is the same boat. How can the boat be the same boat, the riddle runs, if every physical element of the original has been replaced? The answer is that the boat is not made of planks, but of the relationship between planks. If you hammer 100 strips of wood atop each other, you get a wall. If you nail them side to side, you get a deck. Only a particular configuration of planks held together in particular relationship, in a particular order, makes a boat. Genes operate in the same manner. Individual genes specify individual functions, but the relationship among genes allows physiology. The genome is inert without these relationships. That humans and worms have about the same number of genes, around 20,000, and yet the fact that only one of these two organisms is capable of painting the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel suggests that the number of genes is largely unimportant to the physiological complexity of the organism. It is not what you have, as a certain Brazilian samba instructor once told me. It is what you do with it. Perhaps the most useful metaphor to explain the relationship between genes, forms, and functions is one proposed by the evolutionary biologist and writer Richard Dawkins. Some genes, Dawkins suggests, behave like actual blueprints. A blueprint, Dawkins continues, is an exact architectural or mechanical plan with a one-to-one correspondence between every feature of that plan and the structure that it encodes. A door is scaled down precisely 20 times, or a mechanical screw is placed precisely 7 inches from the axle. Blueprint genes, by that same logic, encode the instructions to build one structure, or protein. The factor 8 gene makes only one protein, which serves mainly one function. It enables blood to form clots. Mutations in factor 8 are akin to mistakes in a blueprint. Their effect, like a missing doorknob or forgotten widget, is perfectly predictable. The mutated factor 8 gene fails to enable normal blood clotting, and the resulting disorder, bleeding without provocation, is the direct consequence of the function of the protein. The vast majority of genes, however, do not behave like blueprints. They do not specify the building of a single structure or part. Instead, they collaborate with the cascades of other genes to enable a complex physiological function. These genes, Dawkins argues, are not like blueprints, but like recipes. In a recipe for a cake, for instance, it makes no sense to think that the sugar specifies the top and the flour specifies the bottom. There is usually no one-to-one correspondence between an individual component of a recipe and one structure. A recipe provides instructions about process. A cake is a developmental consequence of sugar, butter, and flour meeting each other in the right proportion, at the right temperature, and the right time. Human physiology, by analogy, is the developmental consequence of certain genes intersecting with other genes in the right sequence in the right space. A gene is one line in a recipe that specifies an organism. The human genome is the recipe that specifies a human. By the early 1970s, as biologists began to decipher the mechanism by which genes were deployed to generate the astounding complexities of organisms, they also confronted the inevitable question of the intentional manipulation of genes in living beings. In April 1971, the U.S. National Institutes of Health organized a conference to determine whether the introduction of deliberate genetic changes in organisms was conceivable in the near future. Provocatively titled Prospects for Design Genetic Change, the meeting hoped to update the public on the possibility of gene manipulations in humans and consider the social and political implications of such technologies. No such method to manipulate genes, even in simple organisms, was available in 1971, the panelists noted, but its development, they felt confident, was only a matter of time. "This is not science fiction," one geneticist declared. "Science fiction is when you can't do anything experimentally. It is now conceivable that not within 100 years, not within 25 years, but perhaps within the next 5 to 10 years, certain inborn errors will be treated or cured by the administration of a certain gene that is lacking. And we have a lot of work to do in order to prepare society for this kind of change." If such technologies were invented, their implications would be immense. The recipe of human instruction might be rewritten. Genetic mutations are selected over millennia, one scientist observed at the meeting. But cultural mutations can be introduced and selected in just a few years. The capacity to introduce designed genetic changes in humans might bring genetic change to the speed of cultural change. Some human diseases might be eliminated. The histories of individuals and families change forever. The technology would reshape our notions of heredity, identity, illness, and future. As Gordon Tompkins, the biologist from UCSF, noted, So for the first time, large numbers of people are beginning to ask themselves, what are we doing? A memory. It is 1978 or 79, and I'm about 8 or 9. My father has returned from a business trip. His bags are still in the car, and a glass of ice water is sweating on a tray on the dining room table. It's one of those blistering afternoons in Delhi when the ceiling fans seem to slosh heat around the room, making it feel even warmer. Two of our neighbors are waiting for him in the living room. The air seems tense with anxiety, although I cannot discern why. My father enters the living room, and the men talk to him for a few minutes. It is, I sense, not a pleasant conversation. Their voices rise and their words sharpen, and I can make out the contours of most of the sentences, even through the concrete walls of the adjacent room where I'm supposed to be doing homework. Jagu has borrowed money from both of them, not large sums, but enough to bring them to our house demanding repayment. He has told one of the men that he needs the cash for medicines. He's never been prescribed any. And the other man that he needs it to buy a train ticket to Calcutta to visit his other brothers. No such trip has been planned. It would be impossible for Jagu to travel alone. You should learn to control him, one of the men says accusingly. My father listens silently, patiently, but I can feel the fiery meniscus of rage rising in him, coating his throat with bile. He walks to the steel closet where we keep the household cash and brings it to the men, making a point of not bothering to count the notes. He can spare a few extra rupees. They should keep the change. By the time the men leave, I know that there will be a bruising altercation at home. With the instinctual certainty of wild animals that run uphill before tsunamis, our cook has left the kitchen to summon my grandmother. The tension between my father and Jagu has been building, thickening for a while. Jagu's behavior at home has been particularly disruptive in the last few weeks, and this episode seemed to have pushed my father beyond some edge. His face is hot with embarrassment. The fragile varnish of class and normalcy that he has struggled so hard to seal is being cracked open, and the secret life of his family is pouring out through the fissures. Now the neighbors know of Jagu's madness, of his confabulations. My father has been shamed in their eyes. He is cheap, mean, hard-hearted, foolish, unable to control his brother, or worse, defiled by a mental illness that runs in his family. He walks into Jagu's room and yanks him bodily off the bed. Jagu wails desolately, like a child who's being punished for a transgression that he does not understand. My father is livid, glowing with anger, dangerous. He shoves Jagu across the room. It is an inconceivable act of violence for him. He has never lifted a finger at home. My sister runs upstairs to hide. My mother is in the kitchen crying. I watch the scene rise to its ugly crescendo from behind the living room curtains as if watching a film in slow motion. And then my grandmother emerges from her room glowering like a she-wolf. She's screaming at my father, doubling down on his violence. Her eyes are alight like coals, her tongue forked with fire. Don't you dare touch him! Get out, she urges Jagu, who retreats quickly behind her. I've never seen her more formidable. Her Bengali furls backward, like a fuse, toward its village origins. I can make out some words thick with accent and idiom sent out like airborne missiles, womb, wash, taint. When I piece the sentence together, its poison is remarkable. If you hit him, I will wash my womb with water to clean your taint. I will wash my womb, she says. My father is also frothing with tears now. His head hangs heavily. He seems infinitely tired. Wash it, he says under his breath, pleadingly. Wash it. Clean it. Wash it. Part 3. The Dreams of Geneticists. Sequencing and Cloning of Genes, 1970 to 2001. Progress in science depends on new techniques, new discoveries, and new ideas, probably in that order. Sidney Brenner. If we are right, it is possible to induce predictable and hereditary changes in cells. This is something that has long been the dream of geneticists. Oswald T. Avery. Crossing over. What a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. William Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2. In the winter of 1968, Paul Berg returned to Stanford after an 11-month sabbatical at the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California. Berg was 41 years old, built powerfully, like an athlete. He had a manner of walking with his shoulders rolling in front of him. He had a remnant trace of his Brooklyn childhood in his habits. The way, for instance, he might raise his hand to begin his sentence with the word look when provoked by a scientific argument. He admired artists, especially painters, and especially the abstract expressionists, Pollock and Diebenkorn, Newman and Frankenthaler. He was entranced by their transmutation of old vocabularies into new ones, their ability to repurpose essential elements from the toolkit of abstraction, light, lines, form, to create giant canvases pulsing with extraordinary life. A biochemist by training, Berg had studied with Arthur Kornberg at Washington University in St. Louis and moved with Kornberg to set up the new Department of Biochemistry at Stanford. Berg had spent much of his academic life studying the synthesis of proteins, but the La Jolla sabbatical had given him a chance to think about new themes. Perched high on a mesa above the Pacific, often closed in by a dense wall of morning fog, the Salk was like an open-air monk's chamber. Working with Renato Dalbecco, the virologist, Berg had focused on studying animal viruses. He had spent his sabbatical thinking about genes, viruses, and the transmission of hereditary information. One particular virus intrigued Berg, simian virus 40, or SV40 for short, simian because it infects monkey and human cells. In a conceptual sense, every virus is a professional gene carrier. Viruses have a simple structure. They're often no more than a set of genes wrapped inside a coat. A piece of bad news wrapped in a protein coat, as Peter Medawar, the immunologist, had described them. When a virus enters a cell, it sheds its coat and begins to use the cell as a factory to copy its genes and manufacture new coats, resulting in millions of new viruses budding out of the cell. Viruses have thus distilled their life cycle to its bare essentials. They live to infect and reproduce. They infect and reproduce to live. Even in a world of distilled essentials, SV40 is a virus distilled to the extreme essence. Its genome is no more than a scrap of DNA, 600,000 times shorter than the human genome, with merely 7 genes to the human genome's 21,000. Unlike many viruses, Berg learned, SV40 could coexist quite peaceably with certain kinds of infected cells. Rather than producing millions of new virions after infection, and often killing the host cell as a result, as other viruses do, SV40 could insert its DNA into the host cell's chromosome and then lapse into a reproductive lull until activated by specific cues. The compactness of the SV40 genome and the efficiency with which it could be delivered into cells made it an ideal vehicle to carry genes into human cells. Berg was gripped by the idea. If he could equip SV40 with a decoy foreign gene, foreign to the virus, at least, the viral genome would smuggle that gene into a human cell, thereby altering a cell's hereditary information, a feat that would open novel frontiers for genetics. But before he could envision modifying the human genome, Berg had to confront a technical challenge. He needed a method to insert a foreign gene into a viral genome. He would have to artificially engineer a genetic chimera, a hybrid between a virus's genes and a foreign gene. Unlike human genes that are strung along chromosomes like beads on open-ended strings, SV40 genes are strung into a circle of DNA. The genome resembles a molecular necklace. When the virus infects the cell and inserts its genes into chromosomes, the necklace unclasps, becomes linearized, and attaches itself to the middle of a chromosome. To add a foreign gene into the SV40 genome, Berg would need to forcibly open the clasp, insert the gene into the open circle, and seal the ends to close it again. The viral genome would do all the rest. It would carry the gene into a human cell and insert it into a human chromosome. Berg was not the only biologist thinking about unclasping and clasping viral DNA to insert foreign genes. In 1969, a graduate student working in a laboratory down the hall from Berg's lab at Stanford, Peter Loben, had written a thesis for his third qualifying exam in which he had proposed performing a similar kind of genetic manipulation on a different virus. Loben had come to Stanford from MIT, where he had been an undergraduate. He was an engineer by training, or perhaps more accurately, an engineer by feeling, genes, Loban argued in his proposal, were no different from steel girders. They could also be retooled, altered, shaped to human specifications, and put to use. The secret was in finding the right toolkit for the right job. Working with his thesis advisor, Dale Kaiser, Loban had even launched preliminary experiments using standard enzymes found in biochemistry to shuttle genes from one molecule of DNA to another. In fact, the real secret, as Berg and Loban had independently figured out, was to forget that SV40 was a virus at all and treat its genome as if it were a chemical. Genes may have been inaccessible in 1971, but DNA was perfectly accessible. Avery, after all, had boiled it in solution as a naked chemical, and it had still transmitted information between bacteria. Kornberg had added enzymes to it and made it replicate in a test tube. To insert a gene into the SV40 genome, all that Berg needed was a series of reactions. He needed an enzyme to cut open the genome circle and an enzyme to paste a piece of foreign DNA into the SV40 genome necklace. Perhaps the virus, or rather, the information contained in the virus, would then spring to life again. But where might a scientist find enzymes that would cut and paste DNA? The answer, as so often in the history of genetics, came from the bacterial world. Since the 1960s, microbiologists had been purifying enzymes from bacteria that could be used to manipulate DNA in test tubes. A bacterial cell, any cell, for that matter, needs its own toolkit to maneuver its own DNA. Each time a cell divides, repairs damaged genes, or flips its genes across chromosomes, it needs enzymes to copy genes or to fill in gaps created by damage. The pasting of two fragments of DNA was part of this toolkit of reactions. Berg knew that even the most primitive organisms possess the capacity to stitch genes together. Strands of DNA, recall, can be split by damaging agents, such as X-rays. DNA damage occurs routinely in cells, and to repair the split strands, cells make specific enzymes to paste the broken pieces together. One of these enzymes, called ligase, from the Latin word ligare, to tie together, chemically stitches the two pieces of the broken backbone of DNA together, thus restoring the integrity of the double helix. Occasionally, the DNA copying enzyme, polymerase, might also be recruited to fill in the gap and repair a broken gene. The cutting enzymes came from a more unusual source. Virtually all cells have ligases and polymerases to repair broken DNA, but there is little reason for most cells to have a DNA-cutting enzyme on the loose. But bacteria and viruses, organisms that live on the roughest edges of life, where resources are drastically limited, growth is fierce and competition for survival is intense, possess such knife-like enzymes to defend themselves against each other. They use DNA-cutting enzymes, like switchblades, to slice open the DNA of invaders, thereby rendering their hosts immune to attack. These proteins are called restriction enzymes because they restrict infections by certain viruses. Like molecular scissors, these enzymes recognize unique sequences in DNA and cut the double helix at very specific sites. The specificity is key. In the molecular world of DNA, a targeted gash at the jugular can be lethal. One microbe can paralyze an invading microbe by cutting its chain of information. These enzymatic tools, borrowed from the microbial world, would form the basis of Berg's experiment. The crucial components to engineer genes, Berg knew, were frozen away in about 5 separate refrigerators in 5 laboratories. He just needed to walk to the labs, gather the enzymes, and string the reactions in a chain. Cut with one enzyme, paste with another, and any 2 fragments of DNA could be stitched together, allowing scientists to manipulate genes with extraordinary dexterity and skill. Berg understood the implications of the technology that was being created. Genes could be combined to create new combinations, or combinations of combinations. They could be altered, mutated, and shuttled between organisms. A frog gene could be inserted into a viral genome and thus introduced into a human cell. A human gene could be shuttled into bacterial cells. If the technology was pushed to its extreme limits, genes would become infinitely malleable. You could create new mutations or erase them. You could even envision modifying heredity, washing its marks, cleaning it, changing it at will. To produce such genetic chimeras, Berg recalled, none of the individual procedures, manipulations, and reagents used to construct this recombinant DNA was novel. The novelty lay in the specific way they were used in combination. The truly radical advance was the cutting and pasting of ideas, the reassortment and annealing of insights and techniques that already existed in the realm of genetics for nearly a decade. In the winter of 1970, Berg and David Jackson, a postdoctoral researcher in Berg's lab, began their first attempts to cut and join two pieces of DNA. The experiments were tedious, a biochemist's nightmare, as Berg described them. The DNA had to be purified, mixed with the enzymes, then repurified on ice-cold columns, and the process repeated until each of the individual reactions could be perfected. The problem was that the cutting enzymes had not been optimized and the yield was minuscule. Although preoccupied with his own construction of gene hybrids, Loban continued to provide crucial technical insights to Jackson. He had found a method to add fragments to the ends of DNA to make two clasp-like pieces that stuck together like latch and key, thereby vastly increasing the efficiency with which gene hybrids could be formed. Despite the forbidding technical hurdles, Berg and Jackson managed to join the entire genome of SV40 to a piece of DNA from a bacterial virus called lambda bacteriophage, or phage lambda, and three genes from the bacterium E. coli. This was no mean achievement. Although lambda and SV40 are both viruses, they are as different from each other, say, as a horse and a seahorse. SV40 infects primate cells, while phage lambda only infects bacteria. And E. coli was an altogether different beast, a bacterium from the human intestine. The result was a strange chimera. Genes from far branches of the evolutionary tree stitched together to form a single, contiguous piece of DNA. Berg called the hybrids recombinant DNA. It was a cannily chosen phrase, hearkening back to the natural phenomenon of recombination, the genesis of hybrid genes during sexual reproduction. In nature, genetic information is frequently mixed and matched between chromosomes to generate diversity. DNA from the paternal chromosome swaps places with DNA from the maternal chromosome to generate father-mother gene hybrids, crossing over, as Morgan had called the phenomenon. Berg's genetic hybrids, produced with the very tools that allowed genes to be cut, pasted, and repaired in their natural state in organisms, extended this principle beyond reproduction. Berg was also synthesizing gene hybrids, albeit with genetic material from different organisms, mixed and matched in test tubes. Recombination without reproduction. He was crossing over to a new cosmos of biology. That winter, a graduate student named Janet Mertz decided to join Berg's lab. Tenacious, unabashedly vocal about her opinion, smart as all hell, as Berg described her, Mertz was an anomaly in the world of biochemists, the second woman to join Stanford's biochemistry department in nearly a decade. Like Loban, Mertz had also come to Stanford from MIT, where she had majored in both engineering and biology. Mertz was intrigued by Jackson's experiments and was keen on the idea of synthesizing chimeras between genes of different organisms. But what if she inverted Jackson's experimental goal? Jackson had inserted genetic material from a bacterium into the SV40 genome. What if she made genetic hybrids with SV40 genes inserted into the E. coli genome? Rather than viruses carrying bacterial genes, what might happen if Mertz created bacteria carrying viral genes? The inversion of logic, or rather the inversion of organisms, carried a crucial technical advantage. Like many bacteria, E. coli carry minuscule extra chromosomes called mini-chromosomes, or plasmids. As with the SV40 genome, plasmids also exist as circular necklaces of DNA, and they live and replicate within the bacteria. As bacterial cells divide and grow, the plasmids are also replicated. If Mertz could insert SV40 genes into an E. coli plasmid, she realized, she could use the bacteria as a factory for the new gene hybrids. As the bacteria grew and divided, the plasmid, and the foreign gene inside it, would be amplified many-fold. Copy upon copy of the modified chromosome and its payload of foreign genes would be created by the bacteria. There would ultimately be millions of exact replicas of a piece of DNA. clones. In June 1972, Mertz traveled from Stanford to Cold Spring Harbor in New York to attend a course on animal cells and viruses. As part of the course, students were expected to describe the research projects that they wished to pursue in the future. During her presentation, Mertz spoke about her plans to make genetic chimeras of SV40 and E. coli genes and potentially propagate these hybrids in bacterial cells. Graduate talks in summer courses typically don't generate much excitement. By the time Mertz was done with her slides, though, it was clear that this wasn't a typical graduate talk. There was silence at the end of Mertz's presentation, and then the students and instructors broke upon her with a tidal wave of questions. Had she contemplated the risks of generating such hybrids? What if the genetic hybrids that Berg and Mertz were about to generate were let loose on human populations? Had they considered the ethical aspects of making novel genetic elements? Immediately after the session, Robert Pollack, a virologist and an instructor at the course, called Berg urgently. Pollack argued that the dangers implicit in bridging evolutionary barriers that had existed since the last common ancestors between bacterium and people were far too great to continue the experiment casually. The issue was particularly thorny because SV40 was known to cause tumors in hamsters, and E. coli was known to live in the human intestine. Current evidence suggests that SV40 is not likely to cause cancer in humans, but the risks were still unknown in the 1970s. What if Berg and Mertz ended up concocting the perfect storm of a genetic catastrophe, a human intestinal bacterium carrying a human cancer-causing gene? You can stop splitting the atom, you can stop visiting the moon, you can stop using aerosol, but you cannot recall a new form of life, Erwin Chargaff, the biochemist, wrote. The new genetic hybrids will survive you and your children and your children's children. The hybridization of Prometheus and Herostratus is bound to give evil results. Berg spent weeks deliberating over the concerns raised by Pollack and Chargaff. My first reaction was, this was absurd. I didn't really see any risk to it. The experiments were being carried out in a contained facility with sterilized equipment. SV40 had never been implicated directly in human cancers. Indeed, many virologists had become infected with SV40 and no one had acquired any cancers. Frustrated with the constant public hysteria around the issue, Delbecco had even offered to drink SV40 to prove that there was no link to human cancers. But with his feet slung on the edge of a potential precipice, Berg could not afford to be cavalier. He wrote to several cancer biologists and microbiologists, asking them for independent opinions of the risk. Delbecco was adamant about SV40, but could any scientist realistically estimate an unknown risk? In the end, Berg concluded that the biohazard was extremely minimal, but not zero. In truth, I knew the risk was little, Berg said, but I could not convince myself that there would be no risk. I must have realized that I'd been wrong many, many times in predicting the outcomes of an experiment, and if I was wrong about the outcome of the risk, then the consequences were not something that I would want to live with. Until he had determined the precise nature of the risk and made a plan for containment, Berg placed a self-imposed moratorium. For now, the DNA hybrids containing pieces of the SV40 genome would remain in a test tube. They would not be introduced into living organisms. Mertz, meanwhile, had made another crucial discovery. The initial cutting and pasting of DNA, as envisaged by Berg and Jackson, required 6 tedious enzymatic steps. Mertz found a useful shortcut using a DNA cutting enzyme called EcoR1, obtained from Herb Boyer, a microbiologist in San Francisco. Mertz found that the pieces could be cut and pasted together in just 2 steps rather than 6. Janet really made the process vastly more efficient, Berg recalled. Now, in just a few chemical reactions, we could generate new pieces of DNA. She cut them, mixed them, added an enzyme that could join ends to ends, and then showed that she had gotten a product that shared the properties of both the starting materials. In November 1972, while Berg was weighing the risks of virus-bacteria hybrids, Herb Boyer, the San Francisco scientist who had supplied the DNA cutting enzymes to Mertz, traveled to Hawaii for a meeting on microbiology. Born in a mining town in Pennsylvania in 1936, Boyer had discovered biology as a high school student and had grown up idealizing Watson and Crick. He He had named his two Siamese cats after them. He had applied to medical school in the early 60s, but was rejected, unable to live down a D in metaphysics. Instead, he had switched to studying microbiology as a graduate student. Boyer had arrived in San Francisco in the summer of 66 with an afro, the requisite leather vest, and cut-off jeans as an assistant professor at University of California, San Francisco, UCSF. Much of his work concerned the isolation of novel DNA-cutting enzymes, such as the one that he had sent to Berg's lab. Boyer had heard from Mertz about her DNA-cutting reaction and the consequent simplification of the process of generating DNA hybrids. The conference in Hawaii was about bacterial genetics. Much of the excitement at the meeting involved the newly discovered plasmids in E. coli, the circular mini-chromosomes that replicated within bacteria and could be transmitted between bacterial strains. After a long morning of presentations, Boyer fled to the beach for a respite and spent the afternoon nursing a glass of rum and coconut juice. Late that evening, Boyer ran into Stanley Cohen, a professor at Stanford. Boyer knew Cohen from his scientific papers, but they had never met in person. With a neatly trimmed graying beard, owlish spectacles, and a cautious, deliberate manner of speaking, Cohen had the physical persona of a Talmudic scholar, one scientist recalled, and a Talmudic knowledge of microbial genetics. Cohen worked on plasmids. He was also an expert on Frederick Griffith's transformation reaction, the technique needed to deliver DNA into bacterial cells. Dinner had ended, but Cohen and Boyer were still hungry. With Stan Falco, a fellow microbiologist, they strolled out of the hotel toward a quiet, dark street in a commercial strip near Waikiki Beach. A New York-style deli with bright flashing signs and neon-lit fixtures loomed providentially out of the shadows of the volcanoes, and they found an open booth inside it. The waiter couldn't tell a kishka from a knish, but the menu offered corned beef and chopped liver. Over pastrami sandwiches, Boyer, Cohen, and Falco talked about plasmids, gene chimeras, and bacterial genetics. Both Boyer and Cohen knew about Berg's attempts to create gene hybrids in the lab. Cohen also knew that Mertz, Berg's graduate student, was making the rounds among the microbiologists at Stanford, seeking to learn techniques to transfer her novel gene hybrids into E. coli. The discussion moved casually to Cohen's work. Cohen had isolated several plasmids from E. coli, including one that could be reliably purified out of the bacteria and easily transmitted from one E. coli strain into another. Some of these plasmids carry genes to confer resistance to antibiotics, to tetracycline or penicillin, say. But what if Cohen cut out an antibiotic resistance gene from one plasmid and shuttled it to another plasmid? Wouldn't a bacterium previously killed by the antibiotic now survive, thrive, and grow selectively, while the bacteria carrying the non-hybrid plasmids would die? The idea flashed out of shadows, like a neon sign on a darkening island. In Berg's and Jackson's initial experiments, there had been no simple method to identify the bacteria or viruses that had acquired the foreign gene. The hybrid plasmid had to be purified out of the biochemical gumbo using its size alone. A plus B was larger than A or B. Cohen's plasmids, carrying antibiotic-resistant genes in contrast, provided a powerful means to identify genetic recombinants. Evolution would be conscripted to help their experiment. Natural selection, deployed in a petri dish, would naturally select their hybrid plasmids. The transference of antibiotic resistance from one bacterium to another bacterium would confirm that the gene hybrid or recombinant DNA had been created. But what of Berg and Jackson's technical hurdles? If the genetic chimeras were produced at a 1 in a million frequency, then no selection method, however deft or powerful, would work. There would be no hybrids to select. On a whim, Boyer began to describe the DNA-cutting enzymes and Mertz's improved process to generate gene hybrids with greater efficiency. There was silence as Cohen and Boyer tossed the idea around in their minds. The convergence was inevitable. Boyer had purified enzymes to create gene hybrids with vastly improved efficiency. Cohen had isolated plasmids that could be selected and propagated easily in bacteria. The thought, Falco recalls, was too obvious to slip by unnoticed. Cohen spoke in a slow, clear voice. That means... Boyer cut him off mid-thought. That's right. It should be possible. Sometimes in science, as in the rest of life, Falco later wrote, it is not necessary to finish the sentence or thought. The experiment was straightforward enough, so magnificently simple that it could be performed over the course of a single afternoon with standard reagents. Mix ECOR1 cut plasmid DNA molecules and rejoin them, and there should be a proportion of recombinant plasmid molecules. Use antibiotic resistance to select the bacteria that had acquired the foreign gene, and you would select the hybrid DNA. Grow one such bacterial cell into its million descendants, and you would amplify the hybrid DNA a millionfold. You would clone recombinant DNA. The experiment was not just innovative and efficient, it was also potentially safer. Unlike Berg and Mertz's experiment involving virus-bacteria hybrids, Cohen and Boyer's chimeras were composed entirely of bacterial genes, which they considered far less hazardous. They could find no reason to halt the creation of these plasmids. Bacteria, after all, were capable of trading genetic material like gossip, with scarcely an afterthought. Free trade in genes was a hallmark of the microbial world. Through that winter and into the early spring of 1973, Boyer and Cohen worked furiously to make their genetic hybrids. Plasmids and enzymes shuttled between UCSF and Stanford, up and down Highway 101, on a Volkswagen Beetle driven by a research assistant from Boyer's lab. A few thousand feet from Cohen's lab, Berg and Mertz were also working on their experiments. They knew distantly about Cohen's forays into recombinant DNA, but their own efforts were still focused on optimizing the reaction in a test tube. By the end of the summer, Boyer and Cohen had successfully created their gene hybrids, two pieces of genetic material from two bacteria stitched together to form a single chimera. Boyer later recalled the moment of discovery with immense clarity. I looked at the first gels, and I remember tears coming into my eyes. It was so nice. Hereditary identities borrowed from two organisms had been shuffled around to form a new one. It was as close to metaphysics as one could get. In February 1973, Boyer and Cohen were ready to propagate the first artificially produced genetic chimera in living cells. They cut two bacterial plasmids open with restriction enzymes and swapped the genetic material from one plasmid into another. The plasmid carrying the hybrid DNA was locked shut with ligase, and the resultant chimera introduced into bacterial cells using a modified version of the transformation reaction. The bacteria containing the gene hybrids were grown on petri dishes to form tiny translucent colonies, glistening like pearls on agar. Sometime late one evening, Cohen inoculated a vat of sterile bacterial broth with a single colony of bacterial cells with the gene hybrids. Cells grew overnight in a shaking beaker. 100, 1,000, and then 1,000,000 copies of the genetic chimera were replicated, each containing a mixture of genetic material from two completely different organisms. The birth of a new world was announced with no more noise than the mechanical tick, tick, tick of a bacterial incubator rocking through the night. The new music. Each generation needs a new music. Francis Crick. People now made music from everything. Richard Powers. Orfeo. While Berg, Boyer, and Cohen were mixing and matching gene fragments in test tubes at Stanford and UCSF, an equally seminal breakthrough in genetics was emerging from a laboratory in Cambridge, England. To understand the nature of this discovery, we must return to the formal language of genes. Genetics, like any language, is built out of basic structural elements: alphabet, vocabulary, syntax, and grammar. The alphabet of genes has only four letters, the four bases of DNA, A, C, G, and T. The vocabulary consists of the triplet code. Three bases of DNA are read together to encode one amino acid in a protein. ACT encodes threonine. CAT encodes histidine. GGT encodes glycine, and so forth. A protein is the sentence encoded by a gene, using alphabets strung together in a chain. ACT, CAT, GGT encodes threonine, histidine, glycine. And the regulation of genes as Minot and Jacob had discovered, creates a context for these words and sentences to generate meaning. The regulatory sequences appended to a gene, i.e. signals to turn a gene on or off at certain times and in certain cells, can be imagined as the internal grammar of the genome. But the alphabet, grammar, and syntax of genetics exist exclusively within cells. Humans are not native speakers. For a biologist to be able to read and write the language of genes, a novel set of tools had to be invented. To write is to mix and match words in unique permutations to generate new meanings. At Stanford, Berg, Cohen, and Boyer were beginning to write genes using gene cloning, generating words and sentences in DNA that had never existed in nature. A bacterial gene combined with a viral gene to form a new genetic element. But the reading of genes, the deciphering of the precise sequence of bases in a stretch of DNA, was still an enormous technical hurdle. Ironically, the very features that enable a cell to read DNA are the features that make it incomprehensible to humans, to chemists in particular. DNA, as Schrödinger had predicted, was a chemical built to defy chemists, a molecule of exquisite contradictions, monotonous and yet infinitely varied, repetitive to the extreme and yet idiosyncratic to the extreme. Chemists generally piece together the structure of a molecule by breaking the molecule down into smaller and smaller parts, like puzzle pieces, and then assembling the structure from the constituents. But DNA, broken into pieces, degenerates into a garble of four bases, A, C, G, and T. You cannot read a book by dissolving all its words into alphabets. With DNA, as with words, the sequence carries the meaning. Dissolve DNA into its constituent bases, and it turns into a primordial four-letter alphabet soup. How might a chemist determine the sequence of a gene? In Cambridge, England, in a hut-like laboratory buried half underground near the Fens, Frederick Sanger, the biochemist, had struggled with gene sequencing since the 1960s. Sanger had an obsessive interest in the chemical structures of complex biological molecules. In the early 1950s, Sanger had solved the sequence of a protein, insulin, using a variant of the conventional disintegration method. Insulin, first purified from dozens of pounds of ground-up dog pancreases in 1921 by a Toronto surgeon, Frederick Banting, and his medical student, Charles Best, was the grand prize of protein purification. A hormone that, injected into diabetic children, could rapidly reverse their wasting, lethal, sugar-choking disease. By the late 1920s, the pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly was manufacturing grams of insulin out of vast vats of liquefied cow and pig pancreases. Yet, despite several attempts, insulin remained doggedly resistant to molecular characterization. Sanger brought a chemist's methodological rigor to the problem. The solution, as any chemist knew, was always in dissolution. Every protein is made of a sequence of amino acids strung into a chain. Methionine, histidine, arginine, lysine, or glycine. Histidine, arginine, lysine, and so forth. To identify the sequence of a protein, Sanger realized, he would have to run a sequence of degradation reactions. He would snap off one amino acid from the end of the chain, dissolve it in solvents, and characterize it chemically. Methionine, and he would repeat the process, snapping off the next amino acid, histidine. The degradation and identification would be repeated again and again. Arginine, snap. Lysine, snap. Until he reached the end of the protein. It was like unstringing a necklace, bead by bead, reversing the cycle used by a cell to build a protein. Piece by piece, the disintegration of insulin would reveal the structure of its chain. In 1958, Sanger won the Nobel Prize for this landmark discovery. Between 1955 and 1962, Sanger used variations of this disintegration method to solve the sequences of several important proteins, but left the problem of DNA sequencing largely untouched. These were his lean years, he wrote. He lived in the leeward shadow of his fame. He published rarely, immensely detailed papers on protein sequencing that others characterize as magisterial, but he counted none of these as major successes. In the summer of 1962, Sanger moved to another laboratory in Cambridge, the Medical Research Council, MRC, building, where he was surrounded by new neighbors, among them Crick, Perutz, and Sidney Brenner, all immersed in the cult of DNA. The transition of labs marked a seminal transition in Sanger's focus. Some scientists, Crick, Wilkins, were born into DNA. Others, Watson, Franklin, Brenner, had acquired it. Fred Sanger had DNA thrust upon him. In the mid-1960s, Sanger switched his focus from proteins to nucleic acids and began to consider DNA sequencing seriously. But the methods that had worked so marvelously for insulin, breaking, dissolving, refused to work for DNA. Proteins are chemically structured such that amino acids can be serially snapped off the chain, but with DNA, no such tools existed. Sanger tried to reconfigure his degradation technique, but the experiments only produced chemical chaos. Cut into pieces and dissolved, DNA turned from genetic information to gobbledygook. Inspiration came to Sanger unexpectedly in the winter of 1971, in the form of an inversion. He had spent decades learning to break molecules apart to solve their sequence, but what if he turned his own strategy upside down and tried to build DNA rather than break it down? To solve a gene sequence, Sanger reasoned, one must think like a gene. Cells build genes all the time. Each time a cell divides, it makes a copy of every gene. If a biochemist could strap himself to the gene-copying enzyme, DNA polymerase, straddling its back as it made a copy of DNA and keeping tabs as the enzyme added base upon base, A, C, T, G, C, 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 and so forth, the sequence of a gene would become known. It was like eavesdropping on a copying machine. You could reconstruct the original from the copy. Once again, the mirror image would illuminate the original. Dorian Gray would be recreated, piece upon piece, from his reflection. In 1971, Sanger began to devise a gene sequencing technique using the copying reaction of DNA polymerase. At Harvard, Walter Gilbert and Alan Maxim were also devising a system to sequence DNA, although using different reagents. Their method also worked, but was soon outmoded by Sanger's. At first, Sanger's method was inefficient and prone to inexplicable failures. In part, the problem was that the copying reaction was too fast. Polymerase raced along the strand of DNA, adding nucleotides at such a breakneck pace that Sanger could not catch the intermediate steps. In 1975, Sanger made an ingenious modification. He spiked the copying reaction with a series of chemically altered bases, ever so slight variants of A, C, G, and T, that were still recognized by DNA polymerase, but jammed its copying ability. As polymerase stalled, Sanger could use the slowed-down reaction to map a gene by its jams, an A here, a T there, a G there, and so forth, for thousands of bases of DNA. On February 24, 1977, Sanger used this technique to reveal the full sequence of a virus, Phi-Chi-174, in a paper in Nature. Only 5,386 base pairs in length, Phi was a tiny virus. Its entire genome was smaller than some of the smallest human genes. But the publication announced a transformative scientific advance. The sequence identifies many of the features responsible for the production of the proteins of the 9 known genes of the organism, he wrote. Sanger had learned to read the language of genes. The new techniques of genetics, gene sequencing and gene cloning, immediately illuminated novel characteristics of genes and genomes. The first and most surprising discovery concerned a unique feature of the genes of animals and animal viruses. In 1977, two scientists working independently, Richard Roberts and Philip Sharp, discovered that most animal proteins were not encoded in long continuous stretches of DNA, but were actually split into modules. In bacteria, every gene is a continuous, uninterrupted stretch of DNA, starting with the first triplet code, ATG, and running contiguously to the final stop signal. Bacterial genes do not contain separate modules, and they are not split internally by spacers. But in animals and in animal viruses, Roberts and Sharp found that a gene was typically split into parts and interrupted by long stretches of stuffer DNA. As an analogy, consider the word structure. than bacteria, the gene is embedded in the genome in precisely that format, structure, with no breaks, stuffers, interpositions, or interruptions. In the human genome, in contrast, the word is interrupted by intermediate stretches of DNA. S, dot, 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 TRU, dot, 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 CT, dot, 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 UR, dot, 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 E, structure. The long stretches of DNA marked by the ellipses, dot, 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 do not contain any protein encoding information. When such an interrupted gene is used to generate a message, i.e. when DNA is used to build RNA, the stuffer fragments are excised from the RNA message, and the RNA is stitched together again with the intervening pieces removed. S dot dot dot, TRU dot dot dot, CT dot dot dot, UR dot dot dot, E became simplified to structure. Roberts and Sharp later coined a phrase for the process, gene splicing or RNA splicing, since the RNA message of the gene was spliced to remove the stuffer fragments, or dot dot dot. At first, this split structure of genes seemed puzzling. Why would an animal genome waste such long stretches of DNA splitting genes into bits and pieces only to stitch them back into a continuous message? But the inner logic of split genes soon became evident. By splitting genes into modules, a cell could generate bewildering combinations of messages out of a single gene. The word S dot dot dot, TRU dot dot dot, C dot dot dot, T dot dot dot, UR dot dot dot, E can be spliced to yield cure and true and so forth, thereby creating vast numbers of variant messages called isoforms out of a single gene. From G dot dot dot, E dot dot dot, N dot dot dot, OM dot dot dot, E, you can use splicing to generate gene, nome, and ohm. And modular genes also had an evolutionary advantage. The individual modules from different genes could be mixed and matched to build entirely new kinds of genes. C dot dot dot, OM dot dot dot, E dot dot dot, T. Wally Gilbert, the Harvard geneticist, created a new word for these modules. He called them exons. The in-between stuffer fragments were termed introns. Introns are not the exception in human genes. They are the rule. Human introns are often enormous, spanning several hundreds of thousands of bases of DNA, and genes themselves are separated from each other by long stretches of intervening DNA called intergenic DNA. Intergenic DNA and introns, spacers between genes and stuffers within genes, are thought to have sequences that allow genes to be regulated in context. To return to our analogy, these regions might be described as long ellipses scattered with occasional punctuation marks. The human genome can thus be thought of as this dot 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 is dot 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 the dot 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 parentheses dot 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 s dot 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 truck dot 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 sure dot 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 of dot 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 your dot 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 gene dot ohm dot e. The words represent genes. The long ellipses between the words represent the stretches of intergenic DNA. The shorter ellipses within the words, gen dot ohm dot e, are introns. The parentheses and semicolons, punctuation marks, are regions of DNA that regulate genes. The twin technologies of gene sequencing and gene cloning also rescued genetics from an experimental jam. In the late 1960s, genetics had found itself caught in a deadlock. Every experimental science depends, crucially, on the capacity to perturb a system intentionally and to measure the effects of that perturbation. But the only way to alter genes was by creating mutants, essentially a random process, and the only means to read the alteration was through changes in form and function. You could shower fruit flies with X-rays, as Muller had, to make wingless or eyeless flies, but you had no means to intentionally manipulate the genes that controlled eyes or wings, or to understand exactly how the wing or eye gene had been changed. The gene, as one scientist described it, was something inaccessible. The inaccessibility of the gene had been particularly frustrating to the messiahs of the new biology, James Watson among them. In 1955, 2 years after his discovery of the structure of